Unemployment is at its lowest rate in decades, and President Trump hopes voters will remember that in 2020.
I'm a fighter for your jobs, for your wages, your factories, your families, and your dignity.
But that economic message might not hold up across the board, as some swing states are starting to see upticks in unemployment. I'm Tenzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for November 5th. And a new documentary looks at the legacy of Harlem's legendary Apollo Theater and what it's meant to Black artists for more than 85 years.
This is Black Harlem, especially back in the day. Audiences interacted with their artists. You know, they were in dialogue with the artist.
Let's start in those swing states, though. Here we go.
I'm a fighter for your jobs, for your wages, your factories, your families, and your dignity.
That's President Trump boasting about the high rate of employment across the country under his presidency. In the lead up to 2016, the promise of jobs played a major role in his campaign, and it's been a point the administration has continued to drive home.
Today, we are celebrating the one-year anniversary of the White House's pledge to America's workers, a call to action for business and industry to create more and better jobs for Americans.
The national unemployment rate is at one of the lowest levels in recent history, but in some swing states, new data shows upticks in the unemployment rate, places like Wisconsin, New Hampshire, North Carolina, and Michigan, where there are fewer jobs today than just 1 year ago. Joining us now to help us understand all this is Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we're also joined by Arnie Kallberg, a Kennan Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Welcome to The Takeaway, Arnie.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
So, Heather, what does this data actually show us when we talk about unemployment rate? Is it that less people are finding work or looking for work?
Well, it sort of varies state by state, but usually when the unemployment rate is rising, one of two things is happening. One is what we all would think is there's people are losing jobs or there's fewer jobs out there. The other, though, is more of a good trend, and that is when more people are looking for work and maybe they haven't found that job yet, but they're out there seeking a job again, that can also cause the unemployment rate to rise. And specifically, we looked at all the trends to make sure we really understood what was going on in the swing states, and certainly in the states of Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, and North Carolina. What we're seeing is either a plateauing of employment or employment going down, particularly in Wisconsin. So this is not some sort of positive story where more people are simply looking for work and haven't found jobs yet.
Arnie, when we think about the states that Heather just mentioned, Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, Minnesota, what's the economic makeup? I mean, what are the main industries at play here?
Well, these are heavily manufacturing states. In North Carolina, you used to have furniture and textiles. Now you have more high-tech kind of things. In the Midwest, the auto industry has a bigger role, as well as heavy, more what used to be mass production industries.
And Heather, in these states where we're seeing some of these upticks, are there specific populations that are more affected than others? Are we talking about low-wage workers, service industry workers, white-collar workers?
Well, our analysis really dug county by county, because the point is that with the national unemployment rate at 3.6%, that sounds great, but local economies can be very, very different across the United States. We've always known that. That's not a new phenomenon. But what's new this time around is when you look at a state like a Wisconsin, you really see the northern part of the state, which has more agricultural, more manufacturing, more of the low-wage retail jobs, and also the western part of the state are the ones where we've seen more of an increase in unemployment in the past year. So again, it varies county by county. I think when people look at this map, they're really drilling in. From my home state of Pennsylvania, there's parts of the middle that have seen rises in unemployment, whereas outside Philadelphia, those swing critical counties in the Philly suburbs, they look great. Unemployment there has fallen. There are more people working in those areas.
And Heather, we talked to some journalists in some of the places that you mentioned, and they said, you know, a lot of people here on the ground, at least, aren't feeling these changes as significantly? I mean, what do you make of that?
It's early days. What we're showing is the beginnings of a turn. There's no doubt, and I just pulled the numbers before we started talking, that a state like Wisconsin on Election Day in October 2016, or heading into November Election Day, the unemployment rate was 3.9% for the state. Right now, it's 3.2. So for many communities, things are better than it was on Election Day in 2016. But what we're starting to see in some of these places, particularly in the upper Midwest, is we're starting to see that things are a little bit worse than they were a year ago. So for instance, in Wisconsin, we've seen unemployment tick up a couple of tenths of a percent. That may not register to people right now, but when you think about where things could be a year from now, I would be nervous if I'm the Trump economic team if anything got worse in some of these places in Wisconsin or Michigan, because the two biggest drivers for most polling, what can turn an election, it's the unemployment rate getting a lot higher or turnout being a lot stronger. And obviously Michigan and Wisconsin were very close in 2016. If there's more turnout in Detroit and Milwaukee, that could help the Democrats. And if that unemployment rate ticks up, some of these people in the more rural and suburban areas who came out for Trump in 2016 may not be as motivated this time around.
I want to talk a lot more about how this is potentially going to influence 2020 in just a second. Arnie, one of the things we hear a lot about, and we've talked about it a lot on this show, is that we're on the brink of a possible recession. Are any of those fears materializing in some of the data that we're talking about today? Can we tie any of this to any larger national economic trends?
Well, I mean, there has been a recovery. There are many positive indicators in the economy, but the recession is really more about the gross GDP rather than unemployment, but rather than the jobs picture, though the two are related, of course. That may very well be the case. I think a bigger issue for many workers, though, in addition to the unemployment rate, is the quality of these jobs. And while people may have jobs, we have to look at the kinds of jobs they have. Many of these jobs are low wage, in addition to being low skilled. The two are related, of course. And so and many of them don't provide benefits and so on. So while the unemployment rate might say one thing, the quality of these jobs have to be examined as well.
So when we talk about quality, I mean, you mentioned wages. Are we talking about also things like benefits, like health insurance, things like that?
Sure. In the United States, given our employer-delivered system of healthcare and retirement benefits, those are crucial. But it's also things like people having control over their scheduling and what they do during the day. These are things that matter a lot to people in terms of having control over their lives and having control over their days and their family situations and so on.
Heather, let's take a look. You mentioned 2016. Remind us how some of these swing states in particular voted the last presidential election, Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, Minnesota.
Well, obviously, most of these states went for Trump by just a very slim margin. Michigan was the closest, barely over 10,000 votes swinging to Trump, followed by Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. So that's why there's so much attention on the economies in those states. Wisconsin is particularly interesting because in that state, you can register the day of to vote, and there was a particularly high number of white men who came to the polls on Election Day and were able to vote in the state of Wisconsin and mostly went for Trump. And that's why there's been a lot of attention. One of my colleagues was just on the ground in Milwaukee and reporting about efforts in some neighborhoods in Milwaukee to try to encourage more people of color to come out to vote on Election Day in 2020. I think what's interesting to me is and some of the people we talked to for our story, they are starting to notice, say, more people showing up at food banks, more people losing jobs. They weren't necessarily great jobs to begin with. And one of the communities we focus on, Marionette and Marionette County, which is right on the border between Wisconsin and Michigan, the jobs that were lost were these $7, $8, $9, $10 an hour retail jobs. But I think what's interesting is people are not necessarily blaming Trump for what's going on. They don't. I think in the national conversation, we talk constantly about the trade war and what kind of impact that's having on a number of industries, particularly manufacturing and agriculture. But it's interesting. I don't yet hear that quite as much in some parts of these key swing states.
And Heather, what do you attribute that to? I mean, we know, for example, that President Trump's approval rating has hovered around 40% since taking office. And that's, you know, I mean, you know, if you want to look at the impeachment inquiry, the Mueller report, et cetera, et cetera, politics have obviously played a role in that. But this is hitting people's bottom line, if you will, and something that the president definitely campaigned on and continues to drive home. So why do you think there's such a reluctance to connect those two things, even among his base?
I think when I talk to certainly farmers, a number of people will say, look, we want this issue addressed with China. They see it almost in a nationalistic context that I'm willing to suffer a little bit of pain for a bigger long-term gain. Of course, the question is, what is that long-term gain going to be? And that's where a lot of that pressure is on the White House right now to deliver something concrete, a concrete win in this latest round of U.S.-China trade negotiations. So I think that's playing a part as well. And then I think realistically, again, it's everything's about relative positioning. And in a lot of these communities, I often stress to my editors, and when they say, do people think there's going to be a recession? I say, look, the best thing you can do is drive around these communities and look and count how many we're hiring signs are out. I was just in the middle of Pennsylvania recently, and I came back and I said, look, there's still a lot of we're hiring signs up, even though we're starting to see a flattening out of employment levels. So we're not seeing a ton of hiring in some of these states. Until that visible sign of a healthy economy starts to change, it may not impact people's psyches.
Also, to Arnie's point, I mean, we're hiring, but for what, right? I mean, are we hiring for low-wage jobs or part-time jobs? Arnie, when you look ahead to 2020, do you think employment or unemployment, as you will, particularly in these swing states, are going to play a role in the election, whether that means people pointing the finger at President Trump in advance or pointing the finger at President Trump at the ballot box?
Sure. The unemployment rate is the most visible indicator of the health of the job economy, but it's a flawed indicator, as we all know. In fact, our president said that when he was running for election the first time. It's the most phony number he's ever seen. So the unemployment rate is what people think about, and that's what's publicized. But we have to look beyond the unemployment rate to see what the quality of those jobs are and whether or not people are able to make a living for themselves and their family with the jobs that they do have.
Arnie Kallenberg is a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather and Arnie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Tonight, from the Village of Harlem in New York City, the world-famous Apollo Theater, where dreams are born and legends are made, is proud to present It's Showtime at the Apollo.
Testing, can you hear me?
Yeah!
That, of course, is the legendary Aretha Franklin performing at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. And for 85 years, the Apollo has been a springboard for black artists in the United States, paving the way for some of the greatest musicians and comedians of all time. The theater's famed Amateur Night and Showtime at the Apollo series influenced the format of talent competition shows like The Voice, American Idol, and Last Comic Standing. And the indelible cultural contributions of the Apollo are now the subject of a new HBO documentary.
I don't know where any of us would be without all those performances on that stage. The Apollo, it's the beginning of all of it.
That's Pharrell Williams from the new documentary called The Apollo, which airs tomorrow night on HBO. The film covers the theater's legacy and takes a look at its still vital present, documenting the creation of the Apollo stage adaptation of writer Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me. And joining me now is the director of the film, The Apollo, Roger Ross Williams. Roger, thanks for joining me.
It's great to be with you.
Listening to that clip at the top, I mean, it brought me back to being a kid and watching, hearing that introduction on TV. But the Apollo wasn't just around in the 80s. It started 85 years ago. How did the Apollo get its start? What's the origin story there?
Well, the Apollo got its start as the only theater where the black residents of Harlem could go and actually listen to music and be entertained and comedy and dance. Harlem was segregated back then in the 1930s, and black people couldn't go to the establishments like the Cotton Club that we all know about. The Apollo was one of the first theaters to open its doors to black people.
Now, the original owners of the Apollo were actually white. What was their relationship like with the performers?
The Schiffman family, Frank Schiffman. Well, Frank Schiffman, you know, he was a businessman. He wasn't really part of the music community or even part of the Harlem community. He lived in Rye, New York. But he developed a relationship with the artists, but he also kept tabs on the artists. He kept these cards that basically each of their performance, he would sort of grade their performance and say if they were good or bad or talked too much or annoyed him. And that's how he kept tabs and how much he paid them. He famously paid them very little money.
Explain to us Amateur Night at the Apollo.
Yeah, well, Amateur Night was the brainchild of Ralph Cooper. And Ralph Cooper was really Frank Schiffman's partner, let's say, in that Ralph Cooper was Mr. Harlem. He was a Hollywood actor. He was a politician. And he came up with the idea of Amateur Night. And he also was the one who came up with and found a lot of the first artists who were discovered there in Amateur Night. Billie Holiday and famously Ella Fitzgerald, you know, who was a dancer, but decided not to dance at the last minute and sang a song and created Ella Fitzgerald.
Now, the Apollo and Showtime at the Apollo in particular was a late night show that, again, I recall watching as a kid. Some people and those of us who watched it remember that theater had a tough, and some have say some of the world's toughest audience. What made the Apollo's audience different in that way? Because, I mean, if the Sandman came out, it was over.
It was over when the Sandman came out. I mean, this is Black Harlem, especially back in the day. Audiences interacted with their artists. You know, they were in dialogue with the artists. There was a call and response that really harkens back to the Black church. You know, I went there when I was a teenager, and I just remember it feeling like church to me. And the audience in Harlem will tell you how they feel and tell you if you're doing well or if you're not. And that made you a better artist. All the artists I talked to in the film said that made them a better artist because they were terrified of that Harlem audience.
I mean, it wasn't an easy thing. I mean, they would come out and rub the good luck tree that they would rub, the little bark right there, and then get out there and do their thing. And some people would last, what, seconds?
Seconds before the Sandman would come out. And I mean, they had a lot of tactics back in the day. They even had a fake gun. They would shoot. Can't do that nowadays. And they would sweep you off the floor. I mean, there was many ways the Sandman would get rid of you, but it was a brutal audience. It was a brutal crowd, and it tested your talent and your ability. You know, there are people like Dave Chappelle who got booed off that stage 3 times. And you know what? He will swear to you today that it made him the comedian and made him the star that he is today.
If you can handle that, I guess you can handle almost anything. Roger, what was your relationship to the Apollo Theater before you made this documentary?
I was a young NYU student, and I'd go up to Amateur Night. And The first time I went and I sat in that theater and I heard the audience yelling and interacting with the performer, it reminded me of church. I grew up in the Black church. My father's a minister. And so it had this feeling of home. And the Apollo is a church. It's a church to artistry. It's a church to music. It brings you back there. You step into those doors, you feel the power of all those artists who have graced that stage, but you feel it in the walls of that building. And so I always knew the Apollo was a special, special place. And when I got the opportunity to make this film, I jumped on it.
So making a film like this, I'm sure you had access to reels and reels and reels of footage. How did you cut through, literally and figuratively, how did you cut through all of that background footage and figure out where you wanted to focus and who you wanted to focus on?
First of all, it wasn't so easy because as Black people, we are not so great at preserving our history. So my producer, Lisa Cortez, really had to go through people's basements, literally, find moldy old tapes and old photographs. And it was a treasure hunt. It was really a treasure hunt. But once we got all the footage assembled, for me, the important thing was that our music as Black people was how we lifted ourselves from the legacy of slavery and segregation. And so that stage serves as a testament to the power of Black entertainment and Black music. And as long as I stay true to that in the film, whether it's Billie Holiday on that stage singing Strange Fruit, that was a protest song at the time that radio stations wouldn't play, but she could be in dialogue with her audience in Harlem with that song, all the way through to James Brown and his rallying cry in 1968, I'm Black and I'm Proud, a tumultuous year in America. It's how we expressed who we are and where we are and where we are going. And it still continues to do that.
Well, let's talk about that, because I was going to ask you how the Apollo has changed as an institution, where it finds itself today in terms of what it's choosing, what types of productions it's choosing to bring to the stage.
You know, when I had heard that they were staging Ta-Nehisi Coates' seminal book, Between the World and Me, I thought, wow, this is a great way to connect the past to the present, because no one speaks to who we are as Black people in America, the situation, than Ta-Nehisi. I feel like he's the voice of our generation and our time. And so that stage performance, to me, was the way to connect younger people to the past. And then harken that back to James Brown, to Aretha Franklin, to all these artists who stood on that stage protesting in their time, using their music and their art to speak to who we were at that time, and show how much has changed, but also how much has not changed.
Roger Williams is the director of The Apollo, which airs tomorrow night on HBO. Roger, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. If you missed anything or you want to listen back again, check out our podcast. And of course, call us about anything you heard on the show at 877-8MYTAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.